Good evening. It's cooler here. Cooler than where I was. I hope you all are staying cool. It's a bomb. Glad to see you back. Let's do introductions around again.
Britt.
Robert. Jeffrey.
Cheryl.
Dawn.
Ellie.
Pat.
Jennifer.
Wendy.
McDonald.
I have your book. So we're proceeding with this discussion of reality and words and the meaning that comes through words and what we do with the meaning. That's a big part of this. And it wasn't so long ago that there wasn't that much writing going on. Before this was put into words, they didn't have any. They had ancient Hindu scriptures, but the words of Buddha weren't written down until 400 years later after his death. And this Lanka comes at the turn of the century there, at the millennium, and it's new to be talking about stuff like this. And yet, for us, it's also new. It's a new way of looking at how our life appears to us and what we do with the appearance, including the appearance of our own body and mind. In this time, there were many Buddhist practices by that time, the Shravakas and the, I always forget, the Sarvastivadins. And they all had different views, different beliefs, different ideas about how things were. So this material is really a lot about refuting those ideas. And so Buddha keeps showing how they didn't go far enough. Although they were trying, they didn't quite go all the way. All the way, basically, in denying the reality of what we think we see, what we think we are. So I think we're on page 140, but I'm not 100% sure. We talked about the two kinds of knowing last week. Well, the way Red Pine describes it is one kind of knowing functions in private and leads to liberation, and one functions in public and leads to attachment. So, there are two different kinds of meditation, actually. he says it refers back to the object meditation and the beginner meditation. So way back in 37. So I'm not going to go way back. I'm just going to go on to 50, which is the two kinds of knowing. And there are four possibilities. Beyond the reach of sameness, difference, both or neither, existence, non-existence, or neither existence nor non-existence, permanence or impermanence. These are the four possibilities. These are the four different ways of saying it is and it isn't. And the way our mind works, we tend to come down on one side or the other. We like that. We feel comfortable that way. And so we create a world around us based on our proclivities, you could say, the things that we like and the things that we don't like. But, and Buddha says you should practice examining everything, Mahamati, according to these. So attachment, knowing based on attachment to the characteristics of projection, and this is his fundamental point, that we are stimulated by life and project onto it our understanding of it, failing to realize it's coming from us. We are projecting our knowing and understanding. And if our knowing is based on attachment, based on projection, it's erroneous projection of solidity, moisture, warmth, and movement as characterizing the four elements. And it's attachment to proposition, reason, characteristic, and example as the foundation on which such falsehoods are based. This is what is meant by the knowing that is based on attachment to the characteristics of projection. So he suggests that bodhisattvas master these two kinds of knowing. Doesn't say go off into a cloud somewhere. It doesn't say that we don't. It's talking about our attachment to the things that we are. Well, we did this. Their minds focused on the 10 inexhaustible vows. These bodhisattvas bring perfection, others to perfection, and manifest themselves in a variety of refulgent forms. While enjoying the bliss of samadhi and the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. So these are the characteristics of every Buddha. The absence of self among persons and things, and understand the means by which to use their projectionless knowing to examine the stages of practice. So in the next one, says, with form comes space. According to those who cling to mistaken truths, it is the four elements and their elemental forms that give rise to the assemblage of the five skandhas, to our bodies. Consciousness, he says, continues in another existence because of the delight for different realms. The four elements serve as the conditions of the elemental forms, and the four elements do not serve as its conditions. The elements do not arise unless nature, shape, location, and function exist. Or as Dogen used to say, it's all about action. Where the action is in place, in the place where we are. So there are lots and lots of ideas about things, but it's how it enacts itself that is the truth of it. The four elements and their elemental forms are projections of other paths and not mine. He will now explain the characteristics of the self-existence of the skandhas. By what characterizes the self-existence of the skandhas? I mean five skandhas. The five is form, sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness. Four of which are formless, namely sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness. Form. By form, I'm referring to the different characteristics of each of the four elements and their elemental forms. But it's not the case that the formless ones are actually four. They are like the sky. Just as the sky is devoid of numbers or the characteristics of numbers, it is only due to projection that we speak of one sky. The skandhas are likewise devoid of numbers or the characteristics of numbers, and thus devoid of existence or non-existence, and devoid of the four possibilities. Foolish beings talk in terms of numbers, but not the wise. Mahamati, to the wise, forms are illusory. They're designations that are neither separate nor not separate. Just a dream, as a dream or shadow is neither separate nor not separate from a person's body. Mahamati, the realm of Buddha knowledge, appears the same as the projections of the skandhas. This is what is meant by what characterizes the self-existence of the skandhas. You should get rid of projections, and once you do, proclaim the teaching of detachment. And in every Buddha land, put an end to the views of other schools. For once you proclaim detachment, Mahamati, you will be freed from the view of no self among dharmas, and you will reach the unshakable stage. And once you reach that stage, you will gain mastery of the countless samadhis and projection bodies. Just as earth supports everything that lives, so too do bodhisattvas and beings everywhere. So then Mahamati wants to know, please tell us what characterizes the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. and the one path, so that by becoming well-versed in what characteristics the personal realization, Buddha knowledge, and the one path, I and the other bodhisattvas need rely on nothing else to understand the teachings of Buddha. The Buddha said, listen carefully, and I shall now instruct you. Buddha said, the teaching known and passed down by the sages of the past is that projections are non-existent and that bodhisattvas should dwell alone in a quiet place and examine their own awareness. By relying on nothing else and avoiding views and projections, they steadily advance to the Tathagata stage. This is what characterizes the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. Mahamati, what characterizes the one path? When I speak of the one path, I mean the one path to realization. And what does the one path mean? Projections, such as a projection of what grasped or what is grasped, do not arise in suchness. This is what the one path to realization means. The one path to realization is beyond the reach of followers of other paths or shravakas, of pratyeka buddhas, or even Brahma, but not Tathagatas. That's why I speak of one path. So Mahamati says, then why do you teach three paths and not teach one? And Buddha says, because neither shravakas nor pratyeka buddhas enter nirvana by themselves. Because shravakas and pratyeka buddhas attain liberation through training and detachment by the Tathagatas and not through their own power. I do not teach them the one path. Also, Mahamati, I do not teach shravakas and pratyeka buddhas the one path because they have not yet put an end to the habit energy of karma or the obstruction of passion. Because they are not aware that dharmas have no self, they are not free of karmic deaths. I teach them the three paths. So once they've put an end to all the habit energy that gives rise to passion and realize that dharmas have no self, by putting an end to the habit energy that gives rise to passion in their affliction-free realms, they will wake up to the non-existence of the samadhis to which they have been addicted. And once they are awake, they will enter the highest of transcendent affliction-free realms where they obtain an inconceivable, invincible Dharma body complete with every virtue. So even samadhis can become an addiction. And that often happens in practice. And gives a kind of airy feeling to one's life, but it doesn't work. Because even that's an attachment. Even that is a grasping. And we have a taste of that when we go to a retreat, and we had an experience the last retreat, and then we want to have another experience just like that at this retreat. And it never happens. There's always some new thing that happens. And so our expectations are part of the grasping. Our attachment, even to practice, is an attachment if we take it as a self-identification. If we talk about my practice and your practice, it's It's a misidentification. So this is Buddha's little verse. A path for gods and Brahma, one for Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, another for Tathagatas. These are the paths I teach. As long as the mind keeps turning, these paths will never end. When the mind finally ceases, there is no path or one who walks it. The path isn't made. This is my one path to attract and guide all beings. I teach different paths. The three kinds of liberation, just like dharmas, have no self. When passion and knowledge are the same, liberation is transcended. Like floating logs at sea, forever rolling with the waves, thus are foolish Shravakas at the mercy of the wind of characteristics. Though they keep passion from rising, the force of its energy remains. Addicted to the bliss of samadhi, they dwell in affliction-free realms. Not a bad place to go, actually. But having no final goal and having no place to retreat to, in their samadhi-born bodies, they pass through kalpas unaware. Like someone who is drunk, who wakes up when the wine wears off, their awakening is the same, and their Buddha body, too. So, maybe that's enough for tonight. Might want to have discussion. Questions? Donald?
I had to look up three paths. Three paths.
Mm-hmm.
That's the three vehicles, or the one vehicle. Is that kind of the same, or is that the same reference? The vehicle path. The different practices.
It's different realizations. The Pratyeka Buddha is a self-realized. The other one is the self-realized. And Pratyeka Buddha. Oh, I'm so bad about this. I never remember.
I guess really what I was asking you. Buddha usually talks about one vehicle and one path, but here he's talking about the three.
In the Lotus Sutra.
Yes.
Yes.
So I'm taking it that he's doing this as for skillful means again.
Exactly.
That's the people that he has. So
yes.
Even though he, okay, and that's kind of why the question
that
came up.
Yes. Okay. So those bodhisattvas were stuck in samadhi. And
he continues to
open their eyes more. One set of them are attached to characteristics, and the other is in deep samadhi and thinks that's the only place there is. Yeah. And then the Lotus Sutra, which came after this, extemporized on it and put those three in a burning house. And in order to get them out, Buddha lured them out with toys. And the toys were different things for the samadhi was one of them, and beautiful life was another one, and so they came running out of the fire, not because they knew they were burning, but because they were being tempted by all these things. So that's what Buddha was doing, is skillfully trying to get us out of our burning house before we burn up entirely.
And it's also, if I remember correctly, too, is that it's in the Lotus Sutra that he talks more about bodhisattvas.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a little soft in this.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. The age.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Bodhisattva was a fairly new concept in this time. And that's why it's not as...
It's using more of the elder, the traditional.
Yes. Yes. Which is why it's interesting for us, since we're inheriting the bodhisattva practice of saving all sentient beings, as it says, or being with all sentient beings.
That's why I read it. And it's also for me probably why it's not one of my favorites.
Yes.
The Lotus Sutra is just all this lovely, colorful stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stories about all these bodhisattvas.
Big pictures.
Oh, they're just fabulous.
Bodhisattvas rising out of the ground.
It's a whole practice of art.
World's Buddhas all sitting on lotuses. There's some of this. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll start it off.
It could be livelier. Yeah, thank you. It's a good question. Jeffrey?
I've been enjoying our examination of the sutra and at the same time reading other practice books that help dovetail all these words, and there's lots of them, with thinking about someone who would completely soak themselves in their practice, like a hute. And his answer to everything was this one finger that would go up. And to think how somebody who would allow their practice, you know, to soak into their skin and bones, just totally marinate. You know, then.
Yeah.
And in a moment like this, when a student would ask him a question, he'd just do this. I find that the wondrous scope of this practice, that we could spend many, many lifetimes talking about all the words in Buddhism.
Yes.
I've been going through my library, and I've pulled out, as Kelvin Dunn, I've pulled out a book that I read about 25 years ago, Returning to Silence. I didn't really get that book 25 years ago, and now it's just all just every page is so sweet, so golden.
Is that Katagiri? It's Katagiri.
Yeah, and he speaks directly to what we're talking about. You know, I can see it on every page. How he's talking about when we sit in Zazen, we have this, we already come with all these conceptualizations in our head, and we sit with all these concepts. He talked about how, you know, our brain just sits there and secretes, you know, thoughts. We just can't stop. But at the same time, when your practice gets long enough and old enough, and it begins to get calm, serene, you get into places that get real simple. I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's uncomplicated, and all that, not all, but a lot of this conceptualization begins to melt away. You don't get so attached to these wonderful concepts that we know. That's what I'm trying to say. So, I have really found this to be wonderful. Thank you very much.
Do you know the rest of the Gute story?
I don't know. When you say the rest of it?
There was a young student who came to him and was so impressed by his teacher, especially this, no words, but just the finger. And that brilliant, kindly, deep teacher chopped off that boy's finger, which I think is one of the more horrible Zen stories that there are.
And he got it.
And the kid got it, they say. Yeah.
And he really got it.
Not my favorite story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There seem to be a few about amputations. And
yes, there
chop
are.
Chop your arm off and just give it to your teacher.
Ew.
Cutting the cat in half.
Cutting the cat in half. Yeah.
There are metaphors on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a samurai version, for one thing. And, for another, they always wanted to make sure we understood how serious the business is. So, there is more talk about talk and about silence, as you know, because you've been all through it. And we'll get to that pretty soon. Because that's the basis of Zen. And our Soto practice. You know, it was Buddha's silence raising a flower and Mahakashapa smiling because he got it. And something passed between them, but no words. And that's been the basis of our practice ever since. So we can meet each other on that level. Without having to chatter all the time. Well, it's 8 o'clock.